Welcome in to the Drew Buzney Show on this Tuesday evening, a cold, frigid day in Union College. You are listening to the Drew Buzney Show on WRUC 89.7, the first station in the nation. Today on the show, we talk about the firing of Jerod Mayo. We talk about the Celtics getting out of their slump. We look at if the Red Sox have had the best offseason so far in the MLB, and we talk about the lackluster start to the 2025 golf season. All that next on the Drew Buzney Show. As always, my name is Drew Buzney. Thank you very much for tuning in on Instagram, on WRUC, and later this evening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon, wherever you find your podcasts. As pretty much the whole world knows, everyone's been talking about it. The Patriots fired Jerod Mayo 2 hours following the crushing win. Yes, a crushing win against the Buffalo Bills. And you know it's crushing because my dad was left speechless. And you know when Boston sports are on, my dad's yelling at the TV, screaming, everything. But he was in shock because the Patriots won a game they should not have won. They gave up the number one overall pick. They now have the fourth overall pick. And it was Mayo who knew he was going to get fired, holding up the middle finger to all the Patriots fans saying, I know I'm going to go and I'm going to do this to you because, Robert Kraft, you never gave me a chance to succeed as a head coach. You hired me when I really had no experience being a head coach, coming off a team who had 4 wins, a terrible quarterback, a terrible O-line. The only thing good was a defense that Jerod Mayo somehow messed up. But Robert Kraft put Mayo into this position where he expected him to turn a 4-win team with no talent and wasn't spending any money into somehow a Super Bowl contender. And as far as I'm concerned, Jerod Mayo, yes, he was not a good coach, but the blame lies in Robert Kraft. Because first of all, Mayo never should have been hired in the first place. But if you're going to give a guy a shot to be head coach, don't fire him when he sucks. Or when the team sucks, matter of fact. Like, it was not Mayo's fault. Elliot Wolf, who's a terrible GM, and I don't know why he's staying on, didn't go out and spend money and drafted Jalen Polk and drafted Javon Baker and basically had one of the worst drafts. He's as bad of a drafter as Bill Belichick. And yes, his new scouting system hasn't been fully implemented yet. But you can't really go off and fire Mayo. He had the same record Bill Belichick had in his last season. At least you have a quarterback now. I mean, there was no way Mayo was a good coach. There was a lot of mistakes. There was the infamous Take Back Mondays where Sunday after the games, he would basically rat someone out and say, put the blame on someone, and then Monday would be like, oh, that's not what I'm talking about. I mean, that's what everyone does when they get in trouble. But, I mean, Mayo's acting like a college kid or a high school kid, but maybe he wasn't ready to be head coach, but part of me feels bad for him. He was just put in such a bad position. And to be let go when the blame isn't really only on Mayo. It's a systemic problem starting from Robert Kraft, Jonathan Kraft, who, if you've listened to this show before, you know I've been dead against Jonathan Kraft. He sits up in the box with his weird-looking smirk, and he thinks he knows football. Like, what has he ever done to know football? You inherited all your money from your dad, basically. Like, what do you know about life? You know nothing, so keep your mouth shut. Like, who is he to be yelling in the owner's box? Like, cool, you got handed a job to run a sports team. Like, cool. Stop talking, Jonathan Kraft. But it really starts with Robert Kraft. He put Mayo in this terrible position. He hasn't spent money in the last 5 years. And, I mean, how are you going to blame the coach? Your offensive line is terrible. Your defensive line is terrible. You don't have a defense. And, yes, Mayo hired terrible coordinators. Alex Van Pelt's more of a quarterback's coach, kind of an advisor. He didn't really call plays well. And, boy, DeMarcus Covington may be the worst hire in the history of the NFL. That was a fumble of a hire. That defense regressed so much, and it's all the same players. And looking back on this, I'd be like, we should have never fired Bill Belichick because it's evident the coach was not the problem. It's the back office stuff. It's the owner, the lack of a GM, and you can't go ahead and say Elliot Wolf is a good GM because he's really done nothing. The team was terrible. It was a lucky win against the C team, the Bills. The Bills are playing their practice squad players. Everyone's out here, oh, the Patriots won. Yes, we beat little leaguers. That's like when you're in high school and you beat like a first grade team in little league. It's just the comparison that we beat the Bills. No, we beat, basically beat the Raiders or another, the Jets. We beat a terrible team. But the fault lies in Robert Kraft, and I think it's at the point where the fans should be saying, sell the team. And what are you going to do? You're going to hire Mike Vrabel, who seems to be the front runner, and if he has a 5-win season, are you just going to fire him again? Is it just going to be you expect the coach to be the difference on the team? You expect the coach to come in when the team's terrible? You don't have a talent roster. There's no talent on the roster. You expect him to come in and all of a sudden make the 4-win team a Super Bowl contender? I mean, what are you really thinking? The coach can't fix everything. Yes, a good coach is a good coach, and they can make the bad spots less visible. It's what Tom Brady did for so long. He made the roster seem so much better than it was because he's a good quarterback, and that's probably what Drake May is going to end up doing. But at some point, you have to sit back and look that Robert Kraft, Elliott Wolf, they're not going out and they're not letting the coaches work with the best possible product they can. So at the end of the day, it's Robert Kraft. And I'm not saying I stayed and I thought Gerard Mayo was a good coach. I don't think he was a good coach by any means. I think he messed up the locker room aspect. Never once did I see him yelling at a referee or players or any show of emotion. He was Bill Belichick wannabe in terms of emotion, but he wasn't at that stature level. Like, he couldn't do that. At some point, you had to show that you really cared about the team, and at some point, you have to take the blame and say that it's your fault. You lead the coaches. You put that product on the field, and all the reports coming out saying that everything changed day to day, that they felt like the coaches didn't even know what they were doing, and that was on Kraft. He didn't go through a hiring process. He thought Mayo was good 5 years ago, and he kind of set his mind, and that's what he did. He kind of put those the bowling ball fenders up and was like, I'm going to hire Mayo. I'm not going to go through a legitimate coaching process. That's what I'm going to do. And, like, I definitely feel bad for the guy. He was put in a terrible position, but he still was a good coach. So it's going to be interesting. All signs looking towards Mike Vrabel, but it's just going to be interesting to see that what they put behind him, what the back office does, and if somebody goes through another bad year, what's going to happen? And if you want to look at this in terms of Drake May, you have to sit here and think, is all the revolving coordinators and coaches, what's that going to do to his development? So at what point, if you bring in another coach and it's bad the first season, how lenient are you going to be? Because all the turnover is definitely not good for his development. You saw strides with Alex Van Pelt and Ben McAdoo progressing him in the development. But with all the turnover, you only can be left to think what's going to happen to him. Because he's your quarterback of the future. I think all fans can come out and they can say that. But you don't want to ruin the development. Because I'm not comparing him to Mac Jones, but Mac Jones was good the first year under Josh McDaniels. And then you go to Matt Patricia, who's not an offensive-minded coach. And there was all these setbacks. And then, you know, the administration, kind of the organization fell apart. And I'm not saying Mac Jones is a good quarterback, but he didn't really have the support. And I'm worried Drake May is not going to get that. So my hope and prayer is going out that there is some consistency and the Crafts can step up, either sell the team or get their act together. The only other change I really want to see other than firing a Gerard Mayo is DeMarcus Covington, the defensive coordinator, be fired. Because the defense regressed. I know there were injuries, but if you have the same defense and it's the top defense, like, if you don't remember, we won games 6-0, 9-3, or whatever it was. We didn't have an offense, but we at least had a defense, and it regressed so much that, I mean, Bill Belichick is this wizard, and you bring in this really nobody to run the defense, but I feel like if we have a new coach, he's going to wipe that whole slate clean. And from what I've heard, the Drew Busney intel is that Mike Vrabel is going to bring in a bunch of assistants he already has with him. And I heard that Josh McDaniels is one of them. And a lot of my friends are very against that. But personally, I think that's good. I think he's a great developer of coordinators. There's a difference between being an offensive coordinator and a head coach. And Josh McDaniels is a great offensive coordinator. He's not a good head coach. but he knows how to call plays and he knows how to develop a quarterback, and I'm perfectly fine with that. And I don't think at this point he's going to leave us again, because he's left twice and both times he's shown that he's not a good head coach. So if you take Josh McDaniels back, I don't really see the fear of him leaving after 2 years, because he's done it twice and then he comes back to the Patriots. So at what point are you going to realize that he's not really a good head coach? The only other option for head coach I would see is Ben Johnson, the offensive coordinator of the Lions. A great wizard, offensive wizard, which would be great for Drake May. But I worry what's going to happen if you go from rookie coach to rookie coach. Because if we're going to another rookie coach that Ben Johnson is, if he has a bad year, is Robert Kraft going to fire him again? Because he's expecting this rookie coach to make wonders out of this team that sucks. And I think just on the basis, just the coaching skills, the attitude, the behavior, the culture that they set, I think Ben Johnson has a better, can do that better than Gerard Mayo did. Because I don't think Gerard Mayo made a good atmosphere in the locker room in the organization. But I'm positive Ben Johnson can do. But there's a lot of questions that need to be asked to how this administration, the ownership, is going to support the new coach. Because if they're not going to spend money and not going to improve the team, then no coach is ever going to succeed. If we have a winning season, it's going to be all luck. And I just want to take a quick break of my first rant to say that we will have a draft special coming up probably next week where we look ahead to what the Patriots should do in the fourth round pick. Please send me an email. Send me a text at thedrewbusinessshow@gmail.com. Send me a DM. What do you think the Patriots should do with their fourth overall pick? I can tell you right now I'm leaning towards Abdul Carter out of Penn State. But please, I would love to know. And we look towards the offseason goals of the Patriots, because what's the hope in talking about the playoffs? We're not in it. We have $130-ish million, the most in the league. And there's not a great free agent class, but I think the goals are offensive line, because there's some older offensive linemen that I think can be good. Offensive line and linebackers, because we have really slow linebackers. And in this day and age, fast linebackers are the way to go. And I just had one of my experts tell me that the Patriots should trade back. And I'm just going to say, I don't think we should trade back if we get a good haul. And by a good haul, I mean, if we get away a first, I would like to see a first next year just to set us up for the future. But I don't really want to trade out of the top 10, because we still need a talent. So, for instance, if we trade anywhere between, 8 and 10, I'm good with. But I would like a first-round pick, some sort of player that we know is not a nobody that Bill Belichick always traded for, and maybe a third next year or a second next year. We should not go for Shador Sanders. That is a terrible opinion. We do not need a quarterback. But that's my thoughts on the Patriots. I'd love to hear yours, as we're going to move on to talk about the Celtics. And the Celtics have been in a bit of a slump. I know that because it's all my dad complains about. But I contribute that to just the lack of a healthy roster. We've really played 2 games together with that top 8 in Porzingis, White, Brown, Tatum, and Holiday, plus Hauser and Pritchard. And I think the offense isn't where it needs to be. It's just, I'm not a fan of all the threes. We Celtics start the game and it's 3 after 3 after 3 after 3. And I'm not really a fan of that. I think you need to start the game with a well-balanced attack. And if the threes are open, then late in the game, I'm fine hoisting up the threes. But if you start the game with a balanced attack, you may notice that the paint's always wide open, and that's what you can do. And then once they adjust to the paint, you go back to the three-point shot. So it's this three-dimensional offense that I really like. Right now, we're really only the threes, and, you know, it's very rare to see the drive to the paint. So I would love to see that, especially just the start of the game. At the end of the game, middle of the game, if they want to hoist up threes, good. But I would love in the first 5 minutes just to see what the defense, what the other team's defensive game plan is, just so we can react. Because maybe their defensive game plan is to let Jaylen Brown shoot a bunch of threes, or let the whole team shoot a bunch of threes, and then hoist up the threes and see if they go in. But if you realize that they're guarding the perimeter and the paint's wide open, then bam. Pick and rolls, alley-oops, just drive to the paint, because that's what's going to get you there. And at some point, it has to work. Because, yes, if you shoot as many threes as them or more threes than them, yes, you'll get the differential. If you shoot 23s, they shoot 18. Yes, you get that differential, but at the same time, you attempted 50 times, maybe attempted 25 times. But what if you take the 20 odd difference of that and you score a bunch of twos? That's 50 points. There's still a differential there that I think you can work with. But I'm not against the threes. I think the threes are the new day and age of the NBA, but I just wish the start of the game there was more of a balanced attack. Just see what the defense was giving you, because against the Raptors, against the Minnesota Timberwolves last week, I mean, we missed 10 threes in a row, and they don't always go in, and that's when we lose. So just to see a balanced attack. And we have three-point shooters. We have Pritchard. We have Brown. Because once Brown gets into the paint, you know, it's always a turnover. We have three-point shooters, and I'm glad for them to shoot threes. But, I mean, we have Tatum. We have White. We have Porzingis. We have Holiday, who are great down by the rim. I mean, my favorite shot of Jason Tatum's is the fadeaway elbow jumper or anything around the hoop. And I would just like to see the more dimensional, because then you never know what the Celtics are going to do, and you have to guard everything, and then something gets left open. Other than that, I mean, the trade deadline's coming up. I would love a center, just with the slump Al Horford's being in and the inconsistencies he has, Luke Kornet has, Kata has. They're all very hot and cold. And when they're cold, and we really only rely on Porzingis, who's, like, fragile, and if he gets hurt, we have a 50-50 chance of a center doing well. And I just don't want to risk that. I'd like to get an old, reliable guy. I would love Clint Capella. I think he's good. Good bench. And I'm fine getting rid of Kornet and Kata. I just don't think they're very good. I think they have their good games, but if you look at them holistically, I don't think they're the best. As we reach halfway of our show, I just want to remind you, if you're listening on the radio, as per the regulations, you are listening to WRUC 89.7 FM, the first station in the nation, live from beautiful Union College in Schenectady, New York. Again, we are live on Instagram today, going live on Instagram 6 p.m. next Tuesday to talk about all the reactions. We will be having guests on the show in the future. I will be responding to all your comments, all your DMs, all your emails, all your texts. I'll be shouting you out going forward. We have 10 uninterrupted episodes until around late March. And I just want to thank you all for listening today as we reach the last two segments and we talk about the Boston Red Sox. And for those of you that have been my constant followers, you know that I am very negative against the Boston Red Sox. They have done nothing in terms of, for the ownership at least, to set their team up for success. Kind of like the Patriots. They're a little bit like the Patriots. John Henry, Robert Kraft, go get some dinner. Teach each other the skills of ruining a franchise and getting the whole world of Boston to hate you. You know, you can be best friends. You do the exact same thing. You're all terrible people. And I don't like you. Sorry, that was kind of harsh. But you guys can learn a lot from each other about how you run teams in a very poor manner. But there were some good signings. Walker Buehler, especially a one-year deal, coming off an injury. He's going to want to prove himself to get a free agent contract. And so he's going to try his hardest, I guess. Well, everyone does. But he has more incentive to do well, which I'm really looking forward to. We have a couple lefties coming to the pen, which we really struggled with. Our pitching the last years have been absolutely horrendous. So I like the fact that we are signing more people. But with the Red Sox, a team that's really been not good the last couple years, you find themselves overpaying for a lot of players. And you probably find that now in the Patriots going back again, that it's not really a destination because they're not really a winning team. And so you find yourself overpaying. And if you overpay the wrong guy, you're screwed. So I think what we want, I would love Alex Bregman. I'm not a huge fan of long contracts. I know in baseball, there's a lot of 12, 13-year contracts, and there's been one player in Red Sox history that has signed a long contract and exceeded the expectations and has done well for 95% of that contract. But in general, in sports, you know, you sign these huge contracts, and you know they suck after 4 or 5 years, and you trade them, and it's just, I don't always feel it's worth it. I mean, sometimes you have to do it to get the guy. But I just think it ties you up in the future, and you get this guy who's going to suck in 4 years, and you still have him for 5 more years because you signed him to a 9-year contract. But The pitching is going a long way. I'd love to see maybe a trade or two for maybe one more reliever. I think our starters are good once we all get healthy. I'll be interested in signing Nick Pivetta again. I know we have a qualifying offer to him. I heard he's going to go to the Blue Jays. And then the only other thing is some sort of offensive weapons. Alex Bregman is a name off the top of my head, but some sort of offense, especially defense, because our infield defense has been terrible. I think it starts with Devers, who was overpaid. One of the Red Sox did overpay him. They thought he was valued much higher. He's been terrible. Has not lived up to his contract. I think he hasn't really been good. I think we should get him. He's not good defensively. He should hit more home runs. But I think we need some offensive weapons. But I love the route they're going with the pitching, because in recent years, the pitching has been a weakness. And it's really blown games. And our offense has been hot and cold. But when we're hot, we're hot. But if we're hot offense, our defense really lets us down. So it'll be interesting to see. Spring training is really only a month away. So we'll have more Red Sox stuff coming up as more reports come out. But let's transition to golf. And as everyone knows, I'm a huge golf person. I watch pretty much every golf tournament. And last week was the Tournament of Champions, or a signature event. The Century in Hawaii, and Hideki Matsuyama, a member of the Boston Common Golf Team TGO, which tips off tonight at 9 p.m. I'll be watching. It's going to be pretty cool. Root for Boston because we have a Boston team. But the winning score was 35 under. And personally, why do I care about golfers making birdies and shooting low 60s? Like, it's not very fun. I can do that on the PGA Tour Xbox game, which a little bit tangent. I know my brother plays it, and I could definitely beat him, because just like in real life, he probably has no short game. He's like a lot of players. He can hit the ball 300 yards, and then he's going to five putt. So I'd love to challenge my brother, just in a little tangent, in that game. Love to see what happens, see if, you know, his real life golf skills translate to the video games. He's a good golfer, really good golfer. But we'll see what happens. But I have no interest in watching the 35 under tournaments. And it's weird because there's a tournament in PGA National, the Cognizant Classic in the Palm Beaches, that's considerably ranked, or every year ranked, one of the harder tournaments. And none of the big guys play it, partly because it's wedged between signature events and big tournaments like the Players and the Masters and the Arnold Palmer Invitational. But I'd like to see them struggle. I mean, I'd rather a tournament be, the winning score be 10 under than 35 under. There's no appeal to that. Like, cool, you're making a birdie. Like, I don't really care. I'd love to see you struggle for the par like all the other golfers do in the world, like I do. I really have no interest in watching a birdie fest. It's just not really entertaining to watch. I tried to watch it. I was so excited to watch, and I really turned it off. So that's why I really like the U.S. Open, because if they don't get it wrong, like they got it wrong at the LACC, Los Angeles Country Club, usually the tournaments, you know, they're 5-6 under. The Country Club was 6 under. Like, that was great to watch. People were struggling. Yes, they had runs. Scottie Scheffler got, I think, 8 under. But all of a sudden, the course comes up, and it bites you in the rear end, and you're back to this low score, this low single-digit score. And, yes, maybe it's demanding, so maybe we should have less tournaments, but it's really no interest to watch these tournaments. I don't care if you win in the 20s. At best, it should be 15 under wins you a tournament, because that's three, four, five under around, which is great, which I think is what would be great watching, because yes, there's birdies and there's really good shots, but you also see them struggle. So golf is definitely in shambles with everything going on, and just the viewership's going to be down if that's what happens every week. So we'll see that Sony Open in Hawaii, but I really had no interest watching it, and I hope it can get more competitive. And I will say, yes, I would love if the 35 under score had other people around it at 34, 33. Yes, but everyone else was in the high 28s, which isn't fun. There has to be a mix of high scores and competitiveness. And yes, I know every once in a while, a person will run away with the tournament. That happens. But it's happening too much where the courses are too gettable and someone's on and they're shooting 35 under. I just wish the field was more compact, it was more competitive, and when you got to the last 3 hours on Sunday, you still didn't know who was going to win. because that's what good viewership is. And at this point with Golf in Shambles, you kind of have to make it a made-for-TV event because there's no big names all in one place anymore. You have to watch the LIV and PGA. So to get golf back to what it was makes the last hour on Sunday entertaining. That's what I have to say. I would love to hear your comments. I just talked nonstop for about 27 minutes. Please let me know what you think. We'll be back next week on The Drew Buzney Show. Thank you all for listening along, and thank you all for your support. We're on Spotify in just about 20 minutes, so if you want to listen to it again, feel free. Have a nice night and stay safe.